This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a moment, we hear from a longtime member of this country's diplomatic corps, an ambassador to six countries in one of the world's hot zones, the Middle East. First, we're going to spend just a few minutes talking about the snow, the cold, and Charlotte's homeless. Rich Granger is the city's deputy fire chief and Charlotte Mecklenburg Emergency Management Director, and he joins us by phone for a few minutes. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, sir.
I'm sure that you've been probably fairly busy in the last 24 hours, so let's get right to it. How are the roads right now, and how would you say the city and the county have handled this first big snowfall of the winter, so to speak?
Well, the roads are improving. Our primary roads are in really good shape. Charlotte Department of Transportation did an excellent job pre-planning with brine and getting our primaries prepared for this weather. The secondary roads are still a challenge, and they started last night working through those and are going to work through today. Conditions are improving quickly. Sunshine is always a good thing post a storm. This one's been a little bit tricky because it's been changing. You know, we went from a possibility of a dusting to 4 inches and back down to 2 or 3. So we've handled it well. We've worked extremely well between the city and the county and all of its departments, and we've done everything we can, and we've had very minimal impact to, we've had a few extra accidents here and there, but very minimal impact to the community.
I got to tell you, the roads are in pretty good shape. The ones that I took, at least in here to Spirit Square this morning, I didn't have any problems whatsoever. You have to be a little careful because what looks wet is probably ice. But aside from that, what do you think is going to happen tonight? Is this, because the temperature is going to go above freezing today, so this will begin to melt and then the temperature will fall tonight. So will tomorrow morning be perhaps more of a problem than today was?
More of a problem, not really, be pretty much the same. The sun is going to do a good job of getting melting the stuff on the roads and drying it today because we expect a full sunny day all day, mm-hmm. and our road temperatures will be higher than our air temperatures. So road conditions should improve, but there's still going to be patches. Like you said, there's going to be places tonight that look wet. They're going to be icy, especially areas that are shaded more than others with trees or buildings or such to that effect. And we just want people to remember to be cautious and take their time and make sure what they're driving on and drive appropriately.
So our original intent in having you on this morning was to talk about the County Commission's decision on how to handle things for the homeless when the weather turns really cold. They were to have met last night to talk about that, but that meeting was canceled because of the weather. But during the first cold snap of the season early in January, the county took some heat from one of its own commissioners, Pat Cotham, for not opening the Grady Cole Center as a warming center for the homeless. But Grady Cole was opened this time. It opened on Tuesday evening at about 5:30, I'm told, long before the snow started, well before the temperatures fell into the teens. So what changed? Why this time and not earlier in January?
Well, it's based on capacity. We have a tremendous resource here in town with our partners at the Salvation Army, Urban Ministry, and the Men's Shelter. And Urban Ministry also runs an outreach program as well as Room with the Inn, which is area churches that open their doors throughout the week and nights to help with our homeless situation and our population. And what changed was we have protocols and we use them as guidelines, but we base everything on capacity. When our shelter partners have capacity within their respective organizations, there isn't a need for an additional emergency shelter. Most of the time with the cold snap earlier, we had approximately 100 extra beds above beyond the demand. Mm-hmm. What occurred differently this time is there's cold and then there's cold with snow and ice, a big difference. And this time we had more demand because more people wanted to come in. We can't make people come in, but if they want to come in, we will make accommodations for that. And with the snow and everything, it forced more people to want to come inside. So it went beyond our capacity of our normal sheltering program. And so we opened the Grady Cole to handle that.
So am I hearing you say that the county does have a different set of guidelines for when it's not just cold, but it's also snowing and there's ice? There's a different protocol.
It's the same guidelines, but the demand changes. When it snows and ice is occurring, the demand of people that want to come into a shelter increases.
So do you
cold does not create that demand like cold and ice does.
Right. So do you know if most of our homeless population found shelter either with you or with the various privately operated shelters around the area last night?
Most did. We still have a small population that likes to stay where they are, and I respect that, and we can't make anybody come in. But anybody who wanted shelter, CATS helped us work with the transportation. They helped us move the between shelters as well as pick people up and take them to shelters. Mm-hmm. That was all free of charge. The Red Cross was supporting us with extra blankets and cots. And for those that didn't want to come in, we supplied warmers and sleeping bags and supplies to try and make their conditions outside as comfortable as possible.
It isn't often that we see in Charlotte the kind of disagreement that we saw earlier in the month between a county commissioner and the county manager about city or county policy, rather. So as emergency management director, and I know the county commission will be talking about this, but as the management director, do you have any recommendations on what our policy should be, or is it the way it is right now, the way to go?
Well, they invited me to speak, and unfortunately it got canceled last night. And what I think is more important is communication. We have an excellent program in place, and I don't think we have communicated that completely to the people that need to. We can always do better. You know, as a community, we can always do better, and we ought to strive for that. And we need probably to help things with couple sheltering. We do have a pet challenge. You know, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department and their animal control helps us deal with the pets. So there's a few things that we can adjust. But our protocols, wherever you set the protocols, that may or may not trip something. What we need to do is base it on the need, the capacity, and the desire for people that want to come into a shelter, depending on what's going on in the environment. And we just need to be able to adjust accordingly. And we have those plans in place. We have extra facilities around the city that we maintain contact with, and they change a little bit depending on what events are going on in the community. But we always have a place to open a shelter, and we're always ready to do that.
Rich Granger is Charlotte's deputy fire chief, also Charlotte Mecklenburg's emergency management director. Thanks for spending some time with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, from hot to cold, for decades, the Middle East has been one of the world's hot zones. As conflict and tension flare from time to time, the United States has found itself in the middle of it all, and working behind the scenes for this country has been Ryan Crocker. He's been part of the U.S. Foreign Service since the 1970s and has served as ambassador to 6 different Middle Eastern countries since the early 90s. Ambassador Crocker was to have been in town for the World Affairs Council luncheon this afternoon, but that was canceled because of our weather. He was supposed to be in our studio this morning, but the weather hasn't permitted that. He is with us, however, the remainder of the hour by phone from Princeton to talk about the causes and consequences of activities in the Middle East and more. Ambassador Crocker, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
You have served in some of the world's most challenging diplomatic posts. You were director of the Iraq-Kuwait Task Force for the Gulf War. You served as ambassador to Afghanistan and as an ambassador to both Iraq and Pakistan following the U.S. invasion. You were also our ambassador to Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon, and had assignments elsewhere in the Middle East. You were assigned to the American Embassy in Beirut during the 1982 bombings of that embassy and of the Marine barracks attack in 1983. I mean, you've had boots on the ground for most of your professional life in a very dangerous part of the world. This may be an impossible question to answer, but if you had to point to one or two things as reasons for the current state of unrest in that part of the world, what would it be?
Well, Mike, it's a great question. This is more or less the 100th anniversary of the modern Middle East. The lines on the map were literally drawn during the Versailles peace negotiations after World War I and consecrated in the 1919 Versailles Treaty. So it's a moment for some perspective on this. If I were to look at a single cause for much of the disorder we see today, I would say it is a failure of governance. And you start 100 years ago.
A failure of governance in those countries, not ours?
Well, that's a really interesting question that someone else can get to. It started from the beginning. The region had been under the rule of the Ottomans. With the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, other powers stepped in. primarily France and Britain, and started a chain that we still see today. I call it a failure of isms, starting with colonialism, imperialism. The French, the British, the Italians were not overly concerned with developing institutions, laws, capacities for self-government. They were much more concerned on what they could get out of the region. So you see those isms fail. They were replaced by what I would call core country monarchism, places like Iraq and Egypt. These two failed on the grounds of governance and legitimacy. They were seen as tools of the West. You saw then authoritarianism in Iraq and Arab nationalism personified by Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 50s in Egypt. These too failed to provide good governance. They gave way to other systems, Ba'athism, Arab socialism in Iraq and Syria, communism in South Yemen. These too failed. Again, all for the same reason. They did not provide security, stability, education, economic opportunity. You fast forward now to the rise of other isms, Islamism. That too is failing, as we've seen with Islamic State. So the good news, if you will, is that Islamic State is not going to be around as a organized fighting force much longer. The bad news is that the underlying conditions that led to the rise of the Islamic State still persist. So unless or until efforts are made and succeed in providing basic services and security to the people of the area, you're going to see an Islamic State 3.0, just as Islamic State itself was Al-Qaeda in Iraq 2.0.
But, you know, our solution seems to be, when we go into these places, to try to put together some sort of democratic, republican kind of government that operates not unlike our own. Can that work there, given their history and their culture? Are we making almost the same kind of mistake that the British and the French made 100 years ago?
Well, we operate from different motives than they did at that time. We actually do believe that principles as well as interests should guide our policy. We are the greatest democracy on earth. So, yes, I can understand the logic that says try to use our model on others. The problem is it doesn't work. You can't download democracy. You can only upload it. It has to be an indigenous effort. I would just say, Mike, listening to the opening of the show when you were talking to the Director of Emergency Services for Charlotte, something we all take for granted, that would be just unheard of almost everywhere in the Middle East. In this case, a city government that actually looks after its people and provides services and is publicly accountable.
Wow.
That's the kind of thing you need to see to transform the Middle East.
We have
city services.
We have to take a break. We'll talk more about that and about American foreign policy in general with Ryan Crocker, diplomat in residence at the Woodrow Wilson School in Princeton University and former ambassador to many countries in the Middle East at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Chesterbrook Academy, dedicated to preparing children academically, socially, and emotionally for elementary school, hosting an open house on Saturday, January 20th. Details at chesterbrookacademy.com. And Compact Car Service, providing full service for all Honda and Acura vehicles in Charlotte since 1980, located at 6177 East Independence Boulevard. More information at compactcarservice.net. Tomorrow's the local news roundup at 9. We're hit with snow and cold. You may have noticed emergency shelters open for the homeless this time. How did it go? We catch up. The Women's March steps off again this weekend. They'll have nice weather for it. But what progress has been made since last year, and what are they marching for this time? And domestic violence deaths spiked this month in Charlotte. We'll also take a look at the opioid epidemic again and what Governor Cooper has to say about progress there. Our roundtable of reporters talks about those stories and more tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm John Harwood. Coming up on the next On Point, the shutdown showdown. As the DACA deal fades, Republicans are scrambling for a strategy to keep government open, even if it's for only 1 month. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That conversation coming up on Point following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Ryan Crocker, ambassador to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, Lebanon, and other nations at one time or another for the United States. He was to have been in town today, but the weather canceled that visit, but he very nicely said, I'll do it from my home base. And you know, that's why he's with us for the rest of the hour. This is a very complicated part of the world, but President George W. Bush, and you've worked under both Democratic and Republican presidents, President George W. Bush described you as a modern-day Lawrence of Arabia because you've been there so long and you know so much about the area, and perhaps much of that area is unknowable to most people, and particularly with our former government where we change presidents every 4 to 8 years, it's difficult for them to know everything, too. So can we, do we understand this region? Because we keep injecting ourselves, either because we have to or because we think we have to. Do we understand it?
Well, there's a lot out there to try to understand. It is a hugely complex part of the world. You know, when you look at the broader Middle East, which I would define as moving from Morocco in the west on the Atlantic through North Africa, the countries of the Levant, Syria, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, the Arabian Peninsula, and then to the non-Arab countries of the Middle East, the broader Middle East, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Incredible diversity of languages, of cultures, of economies, of religion. There's one important phenomenon they all share, and that is since the basically 1798, when Napoleon invaded Egypt, they all have been occupied by one or more Western armies. And this is fundamental. We do not see ourselves as colonialists or occupiers. Broadly speaking, the people of the Middle East do see us as just that, the successors to the British and the French. Our motives are pure. We're there to bring good things to people who have suffered. Problem is, because of their own history, of which we are largely ignorant, they simply do not perceive us in the same way.
So if they perceive us as imperialists, and imperialists who are not exactly the most dependable people because we come and go and our support ebbs and flows, and our allegiances to certain leaders comes and goes, and sometimes we're propping up leaders who are not the best of characters in that area. How can we be successful if they view us as occupiers?
Well, first, be aware of it. It has always been a source of, you know, real consternation to me how we will get behind a strategy without thinking through what the consequences are. I didn't learn this in Iraq or Afghanistan. I learned it a long time ago in Lebanon. You know, I was there 1982. The Israelis invaded Lebanon to get rid of the PLO, which basically occupied the southern part of Lebanon, and had carried out some pretty horrible attacks across the border into Israel, including one on a kindergarten. So who could argue with that, that the Israeli army would move up through southern Lebanon and get rid of a persistent terrorist threat? Well, we couldn't argue with that, but neither of us, Israel or the U.S., thought about consequences, thought about the fact that 3 years previously to the 1982 invasion, the Shah's government in Iran had been overthrown by a radical Islamist movement, which immediately reached out to Syria to form a strategic axis. That was all known, but we didn't connect dots. So yes, the 1982 invasion got rid largely of the PLO, but what it brought was far worse. It brought Iran and Syria working together to create what eventually became known as Hezbollah, and to turn it against those Western imperialist powers. So 1983, 9 months after the invasion, to put an end to terror from Lebanon, the American embassy in Beirut is blown up. I'm a survivor of that action. 6 months later, October 1983, the Marine barracks were blown up. 244 dead Marines in that incident. These are things the PLO could not have dreamed of doing in all their years of asymmetrical warfare. The Iranians, the Syrians, and their proxies figured it out. So that's the kind of mental process you have to go through. If you're going to invade somebody else's country, you better be thinking about 30th and 40th order consequences, not just third and fourth. And again, we don't do that well. And as you point out, we have a problem with continuity.
Well, you know, yeah, it's one thing not to understand an area as diverse as you said. We think of the Middle East as this block, but it's not homogenous. It's very diverse, and we don't understand all the diversity or the reasons for the diversity and how far back those conflicts go. And sometimes it's hundreds of years. But it's another thing not to read our own or understand the history of the world. I mean, our own experience in the Revolutionary War will tell you that a country being invaded or being occupied by an outside force, the people living there are going to fight back. That seems evident on the face of it. Then we've been conducting this war in Afghanistan for over a decade. The Russians stumbled badly in Afghanistan. Nobody's ever been able to be successful in Afghanistan. England's Queen Victoria lost a war in Afghanistan, and yet we're there. So is military might a wise use of our power in that part of the world?
Well, military force is a formidable thing, and one has to think very, very carefully about how and when and to what end one will use it. And interestingly enough, as I've seen this over time, over many years, military leaders are always the most conservative on that because they know what war is, costly, messy, and with all kinds of unintended consequences. So you see in this country that normally a push for military action isn't coming from the military. It's coming from the civilian leadership. And again, to understand that, I was looking at the paper this morning, New York Times. Here's an example. Secretary of State Tillerson says that U.S. troops will remain in Syria long after the fight against Islamic State is over, so that neither Iran nor Syria take over areas that have been liberated. Mr. Tillerson says, we cannot allow history to repeat itself in Syria. His reference was obviously not very far back in history, the Obama administration. But here's the real history, Mr. Secretary. It's what I just described. The 24th Marine Amphibious Unit came ashore in Beirut in 1982 after a massacre of Palestinian civilians whose safety we had guaranteed in Beirut. It was 24 Mile that was blown up October of 1983. By who? By the Iranians and the Syrians working together and using a Lebanese organization that became Hezbollah. So the secretary is now saying that we should keep several thousand military in Syria so that, guess who, Iran and Syria, the Syrian regime, can't have full sway. Obviously, Mr. Tillerson has never heard of the 1983 attacks, or I don't think he'd be saying that we should keep several thousand troops in a country that will increasingly see us as occupiers to counterbalance the two countries of the region who gave us such grief and pain in the early 1980s.
So you're speaking as a person who has spent almost their entire professional career working in various countries in the Middle East at fairly high levels within our own diplomatic corps. And we have a system in this country where the president is elected, who doesn't necessarily have to have a lot of experience in foreign policy or a lot of knowledge of foreign policy, and where a secretary of state who runs the State Department also doesn't. And in this case, neither of them do. Rex Tillerson was an executive at ExxonMobil, and President Trump was a developer. Didn't know very much. I think it's on the face of it. He would probably, although he would tell you he knows everything about it, doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that he does it. What does that make people like you feel like, who have been on the ground, who know the region, who know the players, who know the internal politics of these countries, when you are ignored?
The important part of that is not getting ignored. Certainly is a broad feeling in the State Department now that that not only are they being ignored, they are being disestablished. Secretary Tillerson seems determined to go ahead with a 31% budget cut for an organization the size of the State Department and Foreign Service in particular. That will literally be devastating. So what I would kind of like to think is that presidents who come to office without broad experience in national security and international affairs, that they will listen closely and ask a lot of hard questions of those of us who have specialized.
Well,
in that
this problem didn't start with the Trump administration. And in fact, during the George W. Bush administration, at a time when the president was calling you our Lawrence of Arabia, you wrote a secret brief for the State Department in advance of our invasion of Iraq. And it laid out pretty much everything that ultimately happened as a result of our invasion of Iraq. You warned that toppling Saddam could unleash long-repressed sectarian tensions, embolden neighbors like Iran and Syria and Saudi Arabia, and throw the region into chaos. You were right. They didn't listen. Does that happen a lot?
Well, we are two very separate entities, if you will. Foreign service, like your military service, is career. We are nonpartisan, just like our brothers and sisters in the military have to be. I'm kind of the poster boy for that. As you noted, I was an ambassador six times, three times for Democratic administrations and three times for Republican administrations. You know, as I went through some of those efforts, I did feel that the Bush 43 administration was listening, not on everything, and crucially, not on the Iraq issue. That paper was drafted by my staff and sent outside the system. We didn't intend to be predictive, to say that A, B, C, D will happen. It was simply to be cautionary. A, B, C, and D might happen. Have you thought this through? How much risk are you prepared to absorb for the outcome you seek? Because it's not that there was an intelligence failure. It's not that we should have figured this all out. It was that we didn't consider, again, that we would be talking about 30th order consequences. No one can predict that. So it's not a question of what you don't know. It's a question of what you can't know and how much risk of the unknown are you willing to take aboard. And we simply did not have that conversation in the run-up to the Iraq War.
I want to talk about what you just said about being nonpartisan, because everybody is partisan in their private life. Because everybody probably in this country votes for one president or another, or one party over the other at the time of an election. So you do take that into the thing. But the actual operation of Foreign Service is not partisan. However, you are buffeted by the winds of party politics, because if the president is from one party or the other, policy is going to change. So how do you deal with that?
It's actually not that difficult, Mike. Yes, of course, we all do have personal politics. I have good friends in the Foreign Service of many years standing. I couldn't honestly or accurately say which party they're a member of, if they're a member of either. You just set that stuff aside. And you always have to remember, as a Foreign Service officer, just as every military officer needs to note, nobody elected us. We answer to the people that the American people elected. Policy is made at one end of Pennsylvania Avenue at the White House, and it's resourced at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue in the Congress. Having a fair understanding of civics in the United States is great training for our Foreign Service as well as our military services.
Some administrations seem to want to use the military in terms of conflicts or settling scores displaying power or keeping an area calm. Other administrations seem to want to focus more on diplomacy. And you've said that since the end of the Cold War, diplomacy and the military have to work together because there are no purely military contingencies. Explain that. And is that what we're doing now?
It is what we're doing now, Mike. With the end of the Cold War, the world changed, and we are still dealing with that change. The first conflict abroad that was post-Cold War was the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. There still was a Soviet Union, but it was on its last legs. And again, one of the critical steps the Bush 41 administration made was to build the best possible relationship with the then Soviet leader Gorbachev. And that turned out to be pretty important. The Russians, the Soviets then, supported the international effort to liberate Kuwait. And that was a political military undertaking, as has every conflict we've been involved in since. You know, that's why the relationship between, say, the ambassador to Iraq and the commander of the multinational force in Iraq have to work together. I was able to do that first with Dave Petraeus, then with Ray Odierno in Iraq, and with John Allen, the force commander in Afghanistan. You have to understand each other's worlds and viewpoints. I had an advantage. I grew up in the military. My dad was a career Air Force. I've always admired the culture. But developing these relationships is going to be absolutely critical for us as we move forward. We've got to understand what your military does and why it does it. And I'll just give you one example of a war that didn't happen.
We have about 20 seconds.
1994, the Iraqis were threatening to invade Kuwait again. I worked day and night with General Benny P., who was Central Command commander, and with his deputies out in the region, Admiral Red down in Bahrain with the naval force.
And let me stop you there. It'll be a cliffhanger. We'll come back to that story and also about diplomacy under Donald Trump in a moment at Charlotte Talks on. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Umstead Hotel and Spa, a hotel inspired by art and nature, featuring Lakeview rooms, local cuisine, and spacious venues for corporate meetings and social events. Information at theumstead.com. And Bricks Wood-Fired Pizza, presenting the new Bricks Rocks app with menu, events, and more. The app is accepted at all locations. Details and download at brickspizza.com/loyalty. Washington scrambles to avoid a government shutdown this weekend. President Trump's comments on immigration appear to have torpedoed the prospects for deals on spending and immigration. And John Harwood, the guest host on Point, will wrangle the troops on that topic and more conversation at 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue our conversation with Ambassador Ryan Crocker about the situation in the Middle East and about the state of our own diplomatic corps in a moment. Stay with us.
Adam Stevens, Principal, the British International School of Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
As an international school, one of our core demographics is families that are looking for a broader and deeper interpretation of the world. WFAE's global coverage and the depth of their analysis attracts that kind of discerning listener that we're looking for. The decision to be an underwriter with WFAE was a really easy one. It's just a really good fit.
Email underwriting at WFAE.org for information.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking this morning to Ryan Crocker, diplomat in residence at Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, former U.S. ambassador to six Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Pakistan, Kuwait, and Lebanon, and the 2009 recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which happens to be the nation's highest civilian award. We're talking about diplomacy, and we're going to be talking about in the next few minutes diplomacy in the Donald Trump era. But first, I'm going to let you finish your story that you were in the middle of a moment ago before we went to the break.
Well, thanks, Mike. So the Iraqis were threatening to reinvade Kuwait to test the relatively new Democratic president. I've lost track of how many conversations I had with the commander of Central Command, General Binny P. There were a lot. I was talking to him a lot more than I was talking to the State Department because we were talking about a war. And again, we had gotten to know each other pretty well. We had confidence in each other. Worked very well together as a team. Took a series of steps that led Saddam to decide invasion was not such a good idea. He made a hard right turn and turned it into an exercise. So that really was my introduction to the essentiality of diplomats and military officers working together.
So we have this necessity for the diplomatic corps and for diplomacy to operate, particularly for the United States, given our power and presence in the world. And this need seems to be rising, particularly in the Middle East, and it's coinciding with a president who does not seem to value the diplomatic corps. The president has belittled the Secretary of State. He has left diplomatic posts unfilled, some have said, you among them, that he has been dismantling the Foreign Service. In an article you wrote with fellow Ambassador Nicholas Burns in the New York Times back in December, you said, the Foreign Service in the United States is facing its greatest crisis due to the president's draconian budget cuts and his dismissive attitude toward diplomats and diplomacy. You have anything further to add to that? It sounds like we are going down the wrong road.
Well, from the perspective Nick and I have, we are definitely going down the wrong road. It is interesting. The most accomplished president in foreign affairs we've had was George Herbert Walker Bush, envoy to China, ambassador to the United Nations, director of Central Intelligence. He knew how the world worked. He also assembled the best national security team around him and involved fully all of the organizations of government that were active in that field, and largely got it right at a critical time for the U.S. I'm seeing none of these things happening now. Here's why it's important. Let's just stick with the military for a minute. So if you're going to war, take Afghanistan post 9/11. Well, you know, to get your forces into the field, you're going to need overflight clearances. You're going to need landing clearances. You're going to need basing arrangements up and down the Arabian Peninsula in that case. The military doesn't negotiate those. The Foreign Service does. You want to have a armored brigade set of tanks and support vehicles pre-positioned somewhere. The State Department does that negotiation. So even if you limit this just to the military, there is a clear institutional link between us.
And is the kind of skill necessary to negotiate, to make those kinds of negotiations, does that come strictly from a State Department that knows what it's doing at the higher levels, or does it come from people like you who have extensive experience in the field?
Ideally, it's a combination. But clearly, it has to rest on the professional services. You know, we have the languages, we've lived out there, we have the relationships, we kind of know how the world works, what we can do and what we cannot, who to ask and who to avoid. And you know, there is no roadmap for this. It's something you develop over years of experience. If you set that aside, you're going to be flying blind in very dangerous times.
And go ahead.
It just will give you, again, an example of what we're seeing. A whole lot going on in and with North Korea these days. Well, that's a pretty hard country to understand. We do not have a Senate-confirmed ambassador in South Korea, nor do we have a Senate-confirmed Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs. This makes no sense.
Is that deliberate? Is that foot-dragging? Is it incompetence? What is it?
I honestly don't know. It seems to be all part of the Tillerson effort to freeze all or most staffing decisions mm-hmm. until he has figured out what he wants the State Department to be. It is no way to do the work of the U.S. government in the international arena.
There was news, I think, this morning of Ambassador of Panama, John Feely, resigning. He resigned on Friday, which allegedly sent shockwaves through the State Department. 60% of the State Department's top-ranking career diplomats have left, and new applications to join the Foreign Service have fallen by half. And colleagues in the State Department who have called Feely one of the leading Latin American specialists said the feelings that he expressed in his resignation letter about not being able to work under President Trump reflect sinking morale within a diplomatic corps that has lost confidence with the administration's approach toward diplomacy. He's not a lone wolf.
He's not, Mike, but here's an important point. You see relatively few resignations on principle from the Foreign Service, just as you see that in the military. You know, most of us, again, do understand how our country works, what elections mean, that they do have consequences. Clearly, Ambassador Feely did what he felt he had to do. That is very unfortunate. I in no way criticize his decision. I respect it. But it will also be used by those in and around the administration who do not like the professional service as an example that they would be disloyal to the commander-in-chief.
Well, Mark
absolutely is not the case.
Mark Feirstein, who was the White House National Security Council Senior Director for Western Hemisphere Affairs under President Obama, said he's surprised more have not left, considering Trump's behavior and policies. And he says, quote, Trump has given ambassadors over the last year many reasons to resign. What are they?
Well, as you may have gathered, I am not drawn to the pro-resignation camp. Again, you have to be true to yourself before you can be true to anything else. I do respect that. But in a sense, for senior officers to start resigning voluntarily, that actually aids and abets the adversaries, the enemies of the Foreign Service in the administration. I have the luxury of not being in right now, but I do know that my senior colleagues that I'm still in touch with who are still at State are doing everything they can to keep good people in, particularly the more junior officers who are wondering if they have a future anymore. I think we got to work through to do everything we can to preserve a great institution and to consider how personal actions can affect that up or down.
The NPR also released a survey today looking back, a study, or I guess it was a survey, of Americans looking into President Trump's first year in office. And they say, it's headlined, majority of Americans see Trump's first year as a failure. They give him positive marks when it comes to foreign policy on his handling of ISIS, but they disapprove of his approach to North Korea. Over 54% of Americans say foreign policy has gotten worse over the past year. A quarter say it's gotten better over the last year. And 70% of Americans fear that we will be getting into a shooting war with North Korea. What does that tell you?
Buyer's remorse. Well, look, the American people are actually pretty good about this stuff. Even with, sadly, so many limitations now through budget cuts on our news media, the story still gets out, and people make, when presented with facts, will make rational judgments. Let's just take Korea for a moment, an area I know nothing about, but that won't stop me from pontificating. We've seen some remarkable things out there. The North and the South coming together for talks, agreeing that the North will be represented at the Winter Games, and agreeing that there would be, for the march in, it will be both Koreas together. Does that mean peace is right around the corner? Of course it doesn't, but clearly a positive development. So here's the question I ask myself. Would that have happened had President Trump taken a more traditional approach to the Korean crisis? Or possibly might it be that he really overturned the apple cart on this one, that it caused the North to say, we might want to do a few things differently? So again, world is a complicated place. We're a complicated country. Beware of single sentence collective judgments. Be open to the fact that we may be looking at an opening that could have been created by a president who didn't do business as usual.
Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright told me on this program several years ago that Kim Jong-un is crazy. People have said that Donald Trump exhibits signs of being crazy. Could it be that these two men are just mavericks in terms of how they deal with each other, how these two nations deal with each other, and taking this alternative approach is having, I think you alluded to this, is having either the desired effect or is having some unintended consequences that could actually turn out to be positive?
Well, that may be indeed be the case. I was just trying to get that out there as a possible thesis. That said, I am no advocate of shooting from the hip and then see what target you hit. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it is a factor in the current situation, but it's highly dangerous. We don't really know how North Korea works. We don't know what motivates them. And saying someone is crazy, that's often just an excuse for a more rigorous analysis of what makes a particular leader, what makes a particular government work.
Well,
what motivates them.
We're seeing this president do a lot of things through tweets, and among them, diplomacy by tweets. He's called Kim Jong-un Little Rocket Man in a tweet. He also tweeted that even after giving Pakistan billions of dollars in aid over the years, Pakistan has given us, quote, nothing but lies and deceit. And he accused them of giving safe haven to terrorists. Take the action of tweeting out of this equation. Remove any judgment about whether the opinion that he expressed in those tweets is right or wrong. Has any president, any world leader been as provocative or as open and frank about what they're actually thinking? And is that helpful or is it hurtful to diplomatic relations?
Well, Mike, you may recall that at the beginning of his first term, President Obama, with great reluctance, handed over his BlackBerry. That, in retrospect, was an amazingly wise decision. The medium can be the message. I think the whole point of tweeting is to have these very short bites that are offered up immediately and without reflection. Not a good way to do business. It does affect the discourse. On Pakistan, I think the president and his advisors are terribly wrong by basically branding a country of 190 million people with nuclear weapons as an adversary. That is not going to take us anywhere good. Clearly, the president does not understand why the Pakistanis think the way they do and do what they do.
But, you know, the Pakistanis have harbored terrorists. That's where we found Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. Could the president's comments have been an attempt to reset what he considers to be a bad relationship by putting them on notice that we're on to them and we are no longer sugarcoating the pill?
Well, again, you got to face reality. There are no black and white situations out there. It's varying shades of gray. I served in Pakistan. I was ambassador there for 3 years. I know what motivates them in part. It was the fact that we cut off all assistance and sanctioned them right after the Soviet defeat in Afghanistan. We didn't need them anymore. They went from being the most allied of our allies to the most sanctioned of our adversaries. Well, that has consequences. That is a major reason why they harbor the Taliban leadership. Bluntly put, you might hear from a senior Pakistani that you're back after 9/11. We're taken while the taken's good, but we know you're going to leave because that's what you Americans do. You stay for a while and then you leave. So if you expect us to take on the Taliban leadership and turn them into a mortal enemy just before you walk out the door, you're completely crazy. Speaking of crazy,
Ryan,
that's the Pakistani narrative.
So
we need to understand it.
We're not reliable in their view, and we are imperialist in their view, as you pointed out earlier in this conversation. Ryan Crocker has been a diplomat or an ambassador for the United States in 6 different countries in the Middle East over the years, 2009 recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and diplomat in residence right now at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.